Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 26th, 2006. Today's session is entitled The Impact of Big Money and Campaign Contributions in Politics, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
In the second week here of talking about public policy issues, I'm a member of the Minnesota State Senate, where I've been there for quite a number of years. I'm serving as chair of the Environment Committee, but I spend a lot of my time on today's issue. It's a particular substantive one to me. It's not just process, but it does have an impact on the substance of just about everything a legislature, U.S. Congress, government does, and that's the impact of money on the political process. And I wanted to start by explaining what the nature of the problem is by using an analogy with the NFL. In Minnesota, there are lots of Vikings fans, and some of our hot rivalries with the Green Bay Packers, as most of you would know. If Minnesota Vikings coach, before a Packer-Vikings game, gave each of the officials $1,000, the Packers go and they protest, say, hey, this is unfair. They're giving money to the officials. Suppose if the NFL didn't, if the Packers couldn't provide evidence that the $1,000 influenced their decision-making, that they threw some calls to the Packers, to the Vikings, because they got the contributions, the league would say, forget it. Of course, that's not the way it works. The league wouldn't allow it to happen in the first place. They would, it's just, no, you don't have to prove there's a quid pro quo. You don't have to prove I gave you the gift and you did a favor to me in exchange to show that that's wrong. The NFL will say it's just plain wrong. And many fields where closely held things like that, where things have to be decided in an unbiased way, you don't want people handing money to others. It's an obvious conflict of interest. Same thing in the courtroom. If you have one of the sides paying the judge, I mean, in certain societies in the past, that's worked. But the idea that somebody would pay an official in a football game is just absolutely not considered. So isn't politics, isn't our government decision-making process more important than a football game? And I would argue it is. I think most of us would say it's a lot more important than a football game. But the rules are different there. In politics, you give big money, you're rewarded for it. Not just in terms of getting good results, I would argue, but in terms of you're respected. They talk about somebody, a lobbyist, who's a big player. He's an insider because he gives big contributions, goes to all the fundraisers. So I'd like to turn from that sports analogy to a sports-related campaign finance issue in politics. In Minnesota, we've been having stadium fights for 10, 15 years. Most states where they've had these fights, the public is not really thrilled with the idea of using tax money for a private business. Minnesota's no different than that. There was a poll in May, Minneapolis Star Tribune, which is a strong proponent of the stadium, poll said, would you favor or oppose using public money for new Twins ballpark? Not surprisingly, given what Minnesota's past history has been, 29% favor using public money for new ballpark, 68% oppose, and of those 68%, 59% strongly oppose. In other words, more than twice as many people as oppose and favor and strongly favor, more than twice that many strongly oppose, so it's well over 2-1 opposition. And yet the legislature, as of a week or 2 weeks after that poll, came through, the governor signed a $390-some million subsidy for the owner of the Minnesota Twins, who happens to be one of 3 or 4 billionaires in Minnesota. Another one happens to own the Minnesota Timberwolves basketball team, and the other billionaires who own the other teams are not from Minnesota. But the poll shows overwhelmingly more than 2-1 public opposes it. Now, I'm not arguing that we should do what majority opinion thinks on every issue, but the people who are most, the politicians who most deeply believe, well, the public says they favor this, we better do it, are the ones who in an issue like this, well, we got to do it. We've got to do it. It's not an essential thing, but it's a nice thing to do. And it became one of the few things this legislative session, our legislature, felt they had to do. Why did it occur? Well, given the topic today, campaign contributions, I'd like to make the case you just follow the money. And in this case, the family that owns the twins, the Polad family, you look at how they did it. You don't even count the lobbyists they had. They had, depending on the year, they've had 5, 10, 15 lobbyists at the Minnesota legislature representing them and trying to get a new stadium. But don't count the lobbyist contribution, just the team owner's contribution. The Polad family gave to legislative leaders of both parties. They gave to the House Republican caucus, the House Democratic caucus, all at the same time, Senate Republican and Democratic caucus. They give to candidates running against each other. In the gubernatorial race in 2002, they gave it to both of the two Republican candidates, they gave it to two of the Democratic candidates, and they gave to the Independence Party. That was our third fairly big party, one Jesse Ventura, the rest were one under. So they gave to five major candidates running against each other, so they had all their bases covered. No matter who won the election, they had given contributions to them. And the governor who did win, incidentally, was opposed to the stadium, though he later on, it became a priority of his, one we had to do. They gave, since the year 2000, they gave the best I could count was well over $200,000, maybe $250,000. That's just one family giving money for doing this. I would make the case that if they, I wouldn't say there's a quid pro quo, they wrote out the checks and the legislature said, oh, therefore we have to give you the money. We have to give you the subsidy. I wouldn't argue there's a quid pro quo, which would be an illegal bribe. I would suggest, however, that it did make a difference, and if it hadn't been for those contributions and the heavy pressure applied by that, the governor at a minimum might have done what San Francisco and a few other communities did, and that is look for a private funding alternative. In 10 years, we've never had a public official push aggressively, the governor push aggressively to get privately financed package in place. I think if it hadn't been for the campaign contributions, the legislators, the caucuses wouldn't have made it the high priority, because this year by the end, they kept saying it's not a priority and we wouldn't take this money from education, we wouldn't take it from transportation or healthcare, but it's a nice thing to do. But then later as the session came on, this is the one thing we have to do yet before we adjourn. And so it became the top priority. And when I wrote a thing about all the money, I suggested that Polad family gave the money in order to get the stadium, which I don't think shocked much of the public, but I was expecting a strong response from the twins, accusing them of all sorts of dastardly things. And so I quoted them on to defend what I was my allegation. And 10 years ago, when they first started pushing for a new stadium, back in 1996, the twins' lead lobbyist was asked by a reporter why the Polads started making big campaign contributions when they had never done so in the past. In fact, Carl Polad is known as a fairly stingy businessman. Other business people say that about him. And he never was a big campaign contributor. And their lead lobbyist, when asked why they started giving the contributions, said, they haven't been before the legislature with a request of this size before, and now they are. That's pretty open about it, if you ask me. And again, the other thing I would distinguish this from, many of you may make campaign contributions. Some of you may give to people of different parties even. But again, I don't know anybody except a handful of lobbyists and interest groups that ever give money to people running against each other. And most people give because they support candidate X, Y, or Z. They support political party A or B. But very, very few people give money to both parties. I mean, I really favor the Democrats, so I'm giving them money. And on the other hand, I really favor the Republicans, and got to do them too. So they give it to both sides. And when reporter asked him why were they giving to both sides, Bob Polad, one of the sons, said, "We don't want to do anything to paint the challenge as a partisan issue. It's not." So I suggested that's the new meaning for the word bipartisan. They're trying to buy both parties. And in our political process, the way it worked here, which is not true of all the big issues like this, but most of their money didn't go to individual legislative candidates. It went to gubernatorial candidates, and then it went to the partisan caucuses. And over the years, all four partisan caucus leaders, the two Democratic and two Republican leaders, all favored this. And all of them got big contributions for the thing. A number of years ago, one of their early fights to get it, I remember both the House Speaker and the House Minority Leader, opposite party leaders, both of them said they were strongly opposed to a stadium, but the bill died in one of the tax committee or someplace, and both of them went and started rounding up members of their committee to pass it, to get it out of there anyway. Well, why would someone who opposes a bill, a leader who opposes a bill, push to get it through anyway? Oh, we're not favoring it. We just want to keep the process alive. Let me assure you, if they really oppose something, they don't try and keep a bill they're trying to kill alive for another committee. But they do give money through both parties. And back to Bob Polad, the son, who was one of the donors, he said, we're not trying to divide by votes. There's probably a group of people who will think that. Yes, we made the contributions. It's the way the world works. And the way the world works for them, again, it was interesting, because when I first started looking at their contributions, it was, you got the sense that the dad and the three sons sat together in a room and wrote out checks, because a whole lot of checks were dated the same date, and how they determined who was writing checks to which ones, I mean, some of them tended to give more to Democrats than to Republicans, and some vice versa, but each one would write a $2,000 check to the House Democratic Caucus, and that same guy would write a $10,000 check to the House Republican Caucus. And they were clearly written about the same date. And so they're sitting in the room, and some tended to give more to that. In the end, I think they gave a little more to the Democratic Party. That tended to be because Democrats were in control more of the years. But let me move on and talk. Quote, Bill Moyers gives some simple facts on what's happening at the national level. The number of lobbyists registered to do business in Washington has more than doubled in the last 5 years. That's from 16,000 some lobbyists in the year 2000 to 34,785 last year, or breaking it down by each member of Congress, is 65 lobbyists for every member of Congress. Full-time people with a lot of money behind them lobbying each member of Congress. The total spent per month by special interests whining, dining, and seducing federal officials. That's, I assume he's not talking about their incomes. He may be, but he says it's nearly $200 million. And he says per month is how much they're spending on our government. Then he talks about how it's a small investment on the return and gives numerous examples of everything from how the Bush administration in the year 2000 came in and gave the energy industry private meetings and gave them the right to set the administration's energy policy. You and I don't have the access to do that, but we don't have that kind of money to give that kind of contributions either. So Bill Moyers, I'm going to quote him one more time. He talks about how big business came along and with, he's a political and religious writer, corrupting the process with big money. Quote, they found a deep flaw in our political system and zeroed in on it. Our elected officials need huge sums of money to finance their campaigns, especially to buy television. The average cost of running and winning a seat in the House of Representatives, the so-called People's House, now tops $1 million. The chairman of the Federal Election Commission said this weekend, and this was in March of this year, he gave this speech, said just this weekend that anyone who expects to run for the nomination for president, the nomination, not the election, in 2008 will need to have raised $100 million by the end of 2007. That money is not coming from regular folks. Less than 0.5% of all Americans made a contribution of $200 or more to a federal candidate. No, the men and women who have mastered the money game have taken advantage of this fundamental weakness in our system, the high cost of campaigns, to sell democracy to the highest bidder. Let me talk briefly, before moving it open to discussion, how special interest money corrupts the process. I would say it does it in two ways, one of which is it determines who runs for office, who wins office. It's the campaign side of it, and then after people are elected, it still has the impact. And the after the election side of it is campaign contributions do play a real part in that. Even if you're opposed to some interest and they give you a $500,000 check, you might be a little less outspoken in your opposition. You might you'll still oppose it. That wasn't enough to turn you around, but it was enough to soften your opposition. And it strengthens your will to support something, perhaps. But it determines not only the campaign contributions, also the constant presence of the lobbyists. In Minnesota, we had same problem most other states had with gift giving to public officials. I authored a bill in 1994. It finally passed. It banned all gifts, including the way they ridicule it. Even a cup of coffee, we're banning them from accepting that. And I actually think that was one of the reasons it took so long for them to pass a stadium bill, because one of the supporters acknowledged to me back in about 97, 98, he said that if it hadn't been for the gift ban, he said half the legislature would have been out to Coors Field in Denver and Camden Yards in Baltimore to look at all these fancy new ballparks. It would have been fact-finding missions, but of course, they would have been paid for by the team. You couldn't really justify billing the state to go to a bunch of ball games. But you'd go out there, fly there with representatives of the team, you'd watch the games, have a great time, and they'd give you a tour of the ballpark, and they'd come back and be convinced it was what we had to do. But so we did pass a gift ban in Minnesota back in 94, mainly because people were scared to vote against it. I was very fortunate. I think I only had one no vote in either house, maybe two, from people who greatly hated it, but there was a lot of pressure because of a scandal and so on. But special interest money, not just in gifts and campaign contributions, but also in just the constant presence. If somebody's there, they want to talk to you, there's only so many times you can say no to somebody, and the ordinary citizen isn't going to be around the Capitol all the time. Some of these folks are constantly there. I notice it when there's a bill up in the Commerce Committee or something. I'll have people from one side, sometimes both sides, come in and tell me what they're going to say in the committee. I tell them, thanks, I don't need to hear it now. I'll hear it in the committee. And it's frankly a lot better that way, because you can challenge them and hear both sides at the same time. When they're one-on-one with you, they say all this stuff, and it's pretty persuasive at times. A lot of legislators commit when they first hear it. So they have, special interest money is called beyond campaign contributions, even beyond gifts, but just by their constant presence, the fact that they can generate what we call astroturf lobbying. It's grassroots is what we like to think of as citizen lobbying. Astroturf is the phony grassroots. And again, the stadium issue is a perfect example of that. I think most legislators thought the public had switched. These polls came out fairly late. They thought most of the public had switched all of a sudden, which is a ploy they tried every couple of years. Oh, I know they strongly opposed it in the past, but now they support it. How will you get constant emails, phone calls, letters from people who are told, I got on the Twins mailing list a number of times. Hey, yes, contact your legislator. Your senator is John Hardy. Tell him to support this. And they give you sample letters to write, emails to send, everything, make it convenient. But they have all those resources that others don't. But that's after somebody's in office. Again, the other way we change public policy is changing who's in office. And that's where campaign contributions have such an impact. I would argue it not only determines who wins, and there are certainly plenty of exceptions that I would suggest prove the rule. Whenever some candidate who's got a lot of money says, oh, no, money doesn't determine the election. Just tell them, well, why don't you switch your money with your opponent's money? If you got twice as much to spend as your opponent, switch the numbers. I mean, nobody do it. Of course not. The money makes a difference. And I can give you plenty of examples where the candidate who was outspent won. But there are exceptions to the rule, not the rule. And it's not only, though, who wins the office, it's who runs for office. Back in the 2000 election, I remember back in 1999 or so, I remember Pat Schroeder and a number of other Democrats were running. Oh, they dropped out because they couldn't raise the money they needed. And in the end, Gore, being vice president, had a lot of advantages, could raise the money. In the Republican side, it was even more telling. The two main candidates, or early on before McCain got into it, the two main candidates were George Bush and Elizabeth Dole. And I don't know enough about Elizabeth Dole to know her philosophy of anything, but I don't really know a lot of areas where she disagreed with George Bush significantly. And I would care to tell you that I don't think they voted for George Bush over Elizabeth Dole because he was more thoughtful or more clear-spoken or anything of the sort. I think he basically got it because the money was behind him. And she dropped out saying she couldn't raise the money. So we determine who runs for office, not just who wins, and also which issues are raised. I think if you take a poll of the American public on universal health care, I think every poll I've seen in the last 20 years is 65% and more supporting it. 60% in politics is generally considered a landslide. Yet, how many major party candidates run for office saying they support universal health care, whatever plan they have for it? And I would argue that you don't talk about those issues. There's nobody funding that issue, and there are plenty of people funding the other side of it. So it very much colors every step of the process. But why do we let this happen? A whole range of things. I would argue at times the media has no stake in changing it. The media that gets our funding for newspaper ads and they get the money for television ads, it's big business for them. They don't have a big interest in changing it. But there are two views of reality on campaign financing. The public is on one side, and public officials, along with consultants and media and pundits and others, campaign volunteers and so on, there are two perspectives on it. The public really believes that that money is corrupting and it makes a difference, that money talks. Politicians really don't believe it does. They think they're honest, honorable people, and they can't be bribed. Bill Moyers, quote him again, he wrote an excellent article probably 7-8 years ago now in Sojourners magazine. It was the cover story, great title. It was Big Money's Assault on Democracy is Not as Bad as You Think, period. You know, the next line, it's worse. And Bill Moyers, who knows the political process in and out, worked for a U.S. president 30, 40 years ago, has covered it at every level from county office to U.S. presidency, is not one who minces words, and he's also not one who exaggerates things. And he's telling the public, which thinks the process is corrupt, it's worse than you think it is. And the public does agree. We had Common Cause in Minnesota, government reform group about 8, 9, 10 years ago, took a poll asking the question, this is Minnesota specific, are politicians more responsive to campaign contributors than to voters who do not contribute? Margin 88-6 said yes. Politicians could be more responsive to people giving money. I'm surprised there's 6% on the other side. But it's landslide of landslides. It's almost unanimous public opinion of that. Money is destroying public confidence in government. But at the other side of it, whenever I've carried campaign finance bills, you get people, political insiders in general, dismiss it as just a public perception problem. The courts have said we can do certain things, put restrictions on, if there's a problem or a perception of a problem, corruption or the perception of corruption. And politicians will say, yeah, there's this perception of corruption, so maybe we should make some modest changes. I'm saying, if it's just a problem with perception, why bother to change it? Just run advertisements to educate people about what the right thing is. But I think my colleagues very truly believe the public is just simply ill-informed. They think there's nothing wrong with it. When I carried the gift ban, I had numerous people say, I'm insulted. You think I could be bought for a $50 luncheon, a $50 gift? You think I could be bought for that? They find it insulting. And I'd argue our process is not one, it's not one of corrupt people. Yeah, there are certainly corrupt people in Washington. There are corrupt people in every state capital. There are corrupt people in almost any profession. But that's not the real problem. It's not a corrupt people that's the problem. It's a corrupt system. Carl Polad and his family and giving money for the stadium contributions, they were following the law. They were absolutely perfectly following the law. I think so. And the recipients of it, I think, were probably all abiding by the law as well. And I don't think most of my colleagues, if you offered them $1,000 in cash and, I'd appreciate your favor, most of them would chase you out of the room or run away from you or whatever they could do. They couldn't get away from you fast enough. It could be partly because of fear of getting caught, but I think it's partly because they'd be offended by it. And so we've got this perception that it doesn't make a difference. And I found an interesting op-ed, I think it was in the New York Times, a few months ago by Dan Gilbert, who's a professor of psychology at Harvard, who wrote, and I'm just going to read you about 5 paragraphs on this, and then because it said it better than I could say it. He said, Verizon had a pretty bad year in 2005, but its chief executive did fine. Although Verizon's earnings dropped more than 5% and its stock fell by more than a quarter, he received a 48% increase in salary and compensation. His handsome payout was based on the recommendation of an independent consulting firm that relied on Verizon and its chief executive's goodwill for much of its revenue. When asked about this conflict of interest, the consulting firm explained that it had, quote, strict policies in place to ensure the independence and objectivity of all our consultants. The columnist writes, please stop laughing. The person who made this statement was almost certainly sincere. Consultants believe they can make objective decisions about the companies that indirectly employ them, just as legislators believe campaign contributions don't influence their votes. Doctors scoff at the notion gifts from a pharmaceutical company could motivate them to prescribe the company's drugs. Supreme Court justices are confident their legal opinions are not influenced by their financial stake in the defendant's business or by their child's employment at a petitioner's firm. Vice President Dick Cheney is famously contemptuous of those who suggest that his former company receive special consideration for government contracts. Voters, citizens, patients, and taxpayers can barely keep a straight face. They know consultants and judges are human beings who are pulled by loyalties and pushed by animosities, and that drug reps and lobbyists are human beings who wouldn't be generous if generosity didn't pay dividends. Most people have been around people long enough to have a pretty good idea of what drives their decision, and when decision makers deny what seems obvious to the rest of us get miffed. Sell our democracy the highest bidder, but don't insult our intelligence. So who's right, the decision makers who claim objectivity or citizens who roll their eyes? Research suggests decision makers don't realize just how easily and how often their objectivity is compromised. The human brain knows many tricks that allow it to consider evidence, weigh facts, and still reach precisely the conclusion it favors. Much of what happens in the brain is not evident to the brain itself, and thus people are better at playing these sorts of tricks on themselves than at catching themselves in the act. People realize humans deceive themselves, of course, but they don't seem to realize they too are human. And I think that very much summarizes the point that I would argue my colleagues in politics miss. And it's not because of corrupt people, it's because of a corrupt system. So what do we do about it? We gotta change it one way or another. I've been trying for as long as I've been in office. First year when I ran for office, I won an upset, and the lobbyist who's still there, a big bucks guy, sent me a contribution in a letter 3 days after the election. I could still quote you almost verbatim the letter because it was a piece of work, and I've used it in many talks over the years. He said, congratulations on the election. You showed hard work, pays off, and so on. He said, one of my clients had the misfortune of contributing to your opponent. Here's a contribution as they wish to make amends. No. I saved the letter. I still have it. What's the misfortune? Well, they gave money to my opponent, and he didn't win. I mean, I'll guarantee you they weren't giving because it was a medical-related issue. I'll guarantee they weren't giving because he was better for better legislator represent to be in the state Senate. I don't think it was even because he was better for their own business. They were giving him money because he was going to win. And they goofed. That was their error. That was their mistake. And they were making amends because, well, at least the thing they could do is offer me a contribution now to make up for it. So I've been trying since I was first elected to try and tighten our laws. And Minnesota had, still maybe has, better than most states. We do have for our state races spending limits, some public financing, and so on. But there are growing loopholes in them, partly because of time and new court rulings and other things that we've got to change our laws to keep up with status quo even. So I've been, back in 1990, 4 years after I was first elected, I changed my personal policy and stopped accepting any, we could accept at the time, I think, contributions up to $1,000. I succeeded a few years later in knocking that down to $500. But set my own limit of no PAC money, no lobbyist money, no soft money where you get somebody to donate large sums to the party and then the party channels it to you or makes expenditures on your behalf. No contributions over $100 from anyone. And I've run successfully 4, 5, 6 times since then under that limit. I did run statewide under that limit for governor, raised over $1 million, which was quite a challenge. But got beat soundly that year. It was not the best year, and some of the media would say it was because of my campaign finance limitations, but I'm not arguing that candidates should all unilaterally disarm, as they would call it, tying one hand behind your back. Minneapolis paper, in their editorial endorsing my opponent in the gubernatorial race, argued that I was naive and foolish, and I was wrong to set a limit gubernatorial race, it's a $2,000 limit. And I was wrong to tie my hand behind my back, one hand behind my back, with a $100 limit, because there's nothing wrong with $1,000, $2,000 contributions. And the editorial writer, I knew who it was, and I talked to her, and I said, you know, you may find no problem with it. I have a real problem with it. I think it's absolutely corrupting, and you're basically, what I was objecting to was your editorial is saying that because you don't think there's any problem with it, I should run by your standards. And but anyhow, I've tried to run it that way myself, and I've been working for now 16, 18 years on clean money funding, which are several, it's similar to what some other states have done. Arizona, Maine, and so on have done some things. They've actually changed the nature of their campaigns. The clean money candidate, in their cases, you turn down all private money in exchange for getting a certain amount of public money. And it's changed. It's greatly increased the number of people who feel comfortable running for office. It's made a tremendous impact that way. But it is, I would argue that this is the number one scandal in American politics. It's been for many, many years. Tom DeLay, Jack Abramoff, I went through a whole talk without mentioning their names until now, but they're poster children for what's wrong. But it is, it affects everything we do in politics, and it's getting worse. And if we care about democracy, we better find a way around it. And with that, I hope it stimulates some discussion, even debate on the issue. Debate is good. But yes.
Yeah, I congratulate you for being one of the few, perhaps, and that I have met that have really been seeking to find an honest way in politics. But I would challenge what you said, that we're not dealing with corrupt people, it's a corrupt system. Where do corrupt systems come from?
I'll concede, I mean, I said earlier, I think there are some corrupt people. But, you know, the whole issue of, I'm not a lawyer, but in criminal law, the thing known as entrapment, I was going to say there are times when you can do something that, and that's with a legality, you're breaking the law, somebody entraps you to do something by tempting you so much. In this case, our whole system is set up in a way, it's set up, I don't think the U.S. Supreme Court in its decisions on campaign finance issues is trying to set up a corrupt system. I think they, misperception not about the importance of the First Amendment, but what the impact of money in politics is. But I don't think it's intentionally set up that way. And yes, I would argue, I think it's wrong, and I'm really offended by the fact that the owner of the Minnesota Twins put all this money in and basically bought themselves a new stadium at public expense. I'm angry at that, and I think it's wrong, but I would not argue that they're corrupt in the sense that you wouldn't trust them if you, however you trust a neighbor and so on. You wouldn't expect them to steal from you. I'm not saying there aren't some corrupt people and some corrupt interests that are trying to twist the law every way they can, but maybe we're having a different definition of what corrupt is, but in terms of that, I think most people on both sides would say, we're good people, we're trying to do the right thing. These are just the rules we're given, so we're playing the game by the rules. But I hear your point.
Yeah, well, you know, after the Second World War, some of the Germans said that we only did what we were told
right.
to do.
Right.
And I...
That doesn't justify
it,
yeah.
I think that some politicians...
It doesn't make it right. I would make a distinction between whether it's right, correct, proper, moral thing to do, or whether it's corrupt, but that might be a definitional point there too. Yes, over there.
Yeah, well, I think it's like if you put a turtle in cold water and gradually raise the temperature, and our morality has gradually changed and we don't even know it.
We don't realize how...
And it is corrupt.
Yeah, and there are times when we do catch on. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were some changes put in place. We banned corporate campaign contributions at that time. We've stepped in at various times when it's gotten really awful, but it's getting worse fast now, and unfortunately, you got to get out of that hot water at some point, and it's getting worse. Yes.
You gave the analogy of the drug reps or detailers and their influence on physicians prescribing behavior. I'm familiar with from the largest multi-specialty medical practice in the country, the Permanente Group, that about 20 years ago made a decision to not allow detailers into their buildings. What they said to the companies is, if you're interested in educating our physicians, then you can donate money to our physician education program. And, you know, as the purchaser of probably more medication than anybody in the country, the pharmaceutical companies donated that money, and it was put into a pot that then got used for physician education. Is there any way to take that kind of principle and, you know, kind of make an equivalent in the political sphere? Is anything you ever thought
about? Yeah, I've thought about that, and not sure there is. And I think, there are a number of, it's not just the prescription drug issue like that. Lots of newspaper reporters. If I tried to take a reporter out for lunch, we'll go Dutch treat. I don't like them taking me out to lunch either. It's probably more a problem the other way, because I want them to write good stuff. And so there are lots of occupations that have self-imposed ethical standards, or sometimes an association puts those on. I've always thought, whenever people say, oh yeah, the campaign contributions don't bother us, then, you know, well, would people be making the same level of contributions if they were anonymous? I would say no, they wouldn't be, and that doesn't solve the whole problem. But I think in terms of the gift giving, that would work perfectly well. I always told people, well, the National Conference of State Legislators, which is a national group that has conferences and legislators go to them for educational sessions and seminars and so on, all these groups want to sponsor the opening dinner and so on, and our law actually bans our folks from partaking in it. I don't know if some cheats and fudge their way around it, but they always, oh, we got to change that because it just makes us stand out like sore thumb. Well, Wisconsin and some other states have similar laws. I think it would, whenever they say we can't do that, I mean, the counties and the Minnesota Counties Association and the League of Cities, they have this thing about how we've got all these bond writing firms and so on who want to sponsor dinners and so on. And you know, we need that. That helps reduce the cost of our conferences. In my mind, fine, if the bond writing firms want to help out, write out a check to the League of Cities or Association of Counties, and they'll use the money in the way they best see fit. I think it makes good sense. I've used that on the gift portion, but I don't know how you do with the campaign contributions, which is why I think we should take the big private money out of politics altogether. I don't see a simple way to get around that. Yes, Kristen.
Rita Brock has done some research and has figured out that by and large, and I feel sorry about using these terms, but by and large, people with left-wing kinds of interests, when they're concerned about an issue, will take their money and put it into some sort of direct service to solve the problem. People who tend to be sort of on the right-wing end, and again, I apologize because that's not really a fair way to characterize, are the ones who are more likely to send their money to think tanks with good media connections that can just turn on a dime when any issue looks as though it's going to be politically effective to raise for particular candidates. Is the same thing true about when it comes to funding politicians? Do people who tend to go through a social justice agenda tend not to spend a lot of money funding candidates, and people on the other, more business-oriented end, do spend a lot of money?
I don't know if that's a fair characterization. I think that on most issues where there's a interest, a business versus consumer interest, the business side is giving a thousandfold more. When it's business versus labor, it's probably 2-1 more. But in terms of, I mean, there are people, moveon.org and some of the left-wing, if to use your terminology, left-wing groups, some of them had some people donating big bucks. I think George Soros gave large bucks to certain groups like that. So I think there are people on both sides who give big money. The trouble is, in our system, lots of the interests have money and they're competing against somebody else. And part of the problem with our political process is that, you know, if I'm out there looking for a favor to my business, a tax favor to me, it's going to make a big difference to my business, and to everybody else, it's going to have such a minimal impact. Nobody's going to vote on it. nobody's going to be angry enough to contribute or whatever related to it. And an example is Northwest Airlines in Minnesota. We have a gas tax surcharge that kicks on whenever our contaminated soil cleanup program goes, because petroleum spills from gas stations and other things, airports, have caused real contamination things, and you couldn't get the service stations that are responsible, couldn't find the money. So we actually set up a program where they, service station owners, favored imposing a blink-on, blink-off tax that would, a fraction of a cent per gallon, it would be on for a month or two a year, replenishes the fund to a certain level, and then when that wears, when that money is spent on the cleanup program, they re-kick it in. Well, Northwest Airlines buys a lot of fuel, and they were covered by the program too. A couple of years ago, well, you know, they're suffering tough times and so on. In a conference committee on a budget bill at the legislature, I served on the conference committee. One day, a guy from southern Minnesota came in with an amendment. This is 8, 9 in the evening, late in the session, big bill with thousands and thousands of budget items in it, comes in with a thing to exempt Northwest from this gas tax. But was it worth about $2 million a year? I said, well, wait a minute. I mean, you said people, oh, okay. He explained why. You know, they don't really have this kind of gas station spill, and, you know, they shouldn't have to do this. And, you know, they're really struggling as an airline, and we ought to help them out. And I started raising, well, wait a minute. Are we going to have any testimony or anything? Well, no, there was nobody there to have testimony. It was obvious every member of the conference committee, with maybe one or two exceptions, including myself, had not heard about it. But everybody else, most of the members of the committee had been talked to about it. They knew exactly what was going to happen. Long and short of it is they did get it put in the bill, $2 million a year ongoing. Northwest lobbyists and so on, they feel very strongly about it. But the public at large, well, you know, it's a fraction of a cent per gallon of gas. It's $2 million a year among 5 million Minnesotans. It's going to be 40 cents a person. If you break it down evenly, a family of four, it's a buck and a half. I mean, it's not a lot of money, so nobody else is going to give money on that side. Northwest and its lobbyists have big stake at giving. I mean, if they gave $200,000 a year in campaign contributions and lobbying expenses, and they get one $2 million thing like that, that's a 10-to-1 payback. So business interests tend to get more than consumer interests, but both sides are learning that government listens to money. So.
I like your distinction between grassroots and astroturf politics. I wonder whether you think there are significant examples of authentic grassroots support, and whether you think the pursuit of that as opposed to astroturf or big money institutional support is a strategy that's worth pursuing.
I certainly think it's worth pursuing the true grassroots thing. I mean, you don't have much choice but to pursue it. Things have changed in this dramatically. Well, when I was first elected, there was no such thing as email. I wanted to bring in a computer I used in my campaign to the office for word processing stuff because the secretaries had typewriters back then. That's a while back. Now most of the correspondence we get is email. I still remember one of the early stages of the AstroTurf, the phony grassroots lobbying, where one of the tobacco companies was, they were preparing 6 or 8 different letterheads. I mean, they looked like personal stationery. Mr. John Marty, such and such address, so and so. So stationery might be off-white paper and so on. And then a letter written on it, typed, and then they'd send it to the person. The person would sign it and mail it to their legislator. And they had 6 or 7 different typefaces and stationery types and so on, thinking presumably that we wouldn't notice they were all the same, but it was pretty obvious. And since that time, it's so things, strategies change over time. Does true grassroots lobbying work? Yes, and it's not always organized, even grassroots. I'll go back to the stadium issue. Back in 1996, I was the first time they started pushing for a twin stadium. They had given one to Minnesota Timberwolves a year earlier, and I started fighting this, so I opposed that, but wasn't involved particularly. So I got involved fighting this, and in the 96 campaign, some of those quotes I used came from a reporter who dug the poll ad saying how they were giving money in a bipartisan manner and so on. That was from that back then. And I made the argument at that time that they were trying to buy the influence during the campaign. And they were coming up, they had a task force to pull together what they were going to do for stadium needs. It wasn't going to report, it was going to report in July, but it got delayed, and they decided, well, mid-November. And when somebody asked, they said, yeah, it could really be ugly if it came up during the campaign. So I started talking about this, how they were trying to hide it till after the election, then they were going to roll the voters after it. They'd give all the lobbyist campaign contributions, and then they'd hit us afterwards. And that got people riled up to the point that one of my colleagues said every candidate forum, every debate, every speaking stop during the campaign back in September, nobody mentioned stadium. By the end of October, it was the first issue anybody talked about. So in 1997, they failed to get it during the legislative session. So they called a special session. The governor and all the legislative leaders were united, here's what we're going to do. Special session to fund the stadium. And there were a couple of, there's a UCC minister, a woman who was marginally involved, but she got her little grassroots group together and they started speaking to the press, but nobody was organizing grassroots. But we've never had more phone calls. They broke the phone switchboard by overloading it so much. They had to, they shut down the entire Capitol switchboards. People just, they've never had, I mean, I've never seen an issue where there's a fourth as many calls, not a fourth as many. And that was purely grassroots. There was no group doing it. But it's hard to do it. You know, you're in that field. It's hard to organize grassroots, but, and some could say, oh, well, if you're organizing it, well, then it's not grassroots anyway. I mean, what's the difference? Well, one side's got a lot of money and just sending out all these computerized things, and so where you draw the line, I don't know, but I happen to believe people get vocal, worked up about an issue. I think healthcare reform at some point may reach that level. Issues do come up. People do change things, and again, that stadium one was a perfect example where the grassroots made a difference. But 10 years later, they pooped out from... Yes?
I agree that campaign finance is singularly one of the more important issues in politics. But the other piece that I'm concerned about is just how the media of all forms have pretty much given up doing anything
very substantive.
Substantive and useful. And instead, the basic premise is, well, you present one side of the story and then you present the other side of the story. And that means you're being objective, right? As if one side actually has any validity to it. I mean,
right.
You're involved in the environmental stuff, right? And you're probably aware of the fact that we've had years and years and years of articles about global warming where there was no evidence, no truth, no science to the other side. But the press, until really the last year or two, for 15 years or so, have presented as if it's a debate. And part of the, and I hold those folks, reporters, responsible for being lazy, basically, because as long as they put the quote in from each side, they don't have to investigate whether or not there's any validity to either side. And I wonder if there's any, any work that you've done.
Okay.
On
well, first of all, I'll say I agree very much with your choice of wording there. I would say the media is, sometimes it's laziness, but they do feel, you say they report one side, then report the other. Yeah, they don't, there's never... used to be the obligation of one side's lying, one side's telling the truth. Try and find out who's telling the truth. I had some hearings in the Environment Committee last fall because state agency basically lied and did some really atrocious things. They're a pollution control agency. And I was calling them on the carpet on it. One time I even had to put a state employee who I think was interested in telling the truth. I don't think he was a bad guy, but he was not telling the truth. So we don't put people under oath. I haven't seen that happen in 10 years, and I put him under oath, which was highly embarrassing to the guy, but we got the answers we needed that way. Anyhow, the hearings, the commissioner really was a she, so as he said, she said, I accused them of this, and they said, oh no, that's not the case at all. And if you follow the track of emails that I carefully documented and so on, it was pretty clear they were lying. And the reporter said, oh, he said, she said.
Right.
And that's not doing their work, that's not unbiased reporting, that's reporting the spin of both sides and not attempt a chance to do that. On things like global warming, it was because Time magazine did a cover story now saying you ought to be worried, very worried about it. Part of that is...
That was after years and years.
Yes, I know. Part of that is... part of it's the scientific community is moving that way, too. There were more doubts about it because it's such a complex thing. Because we might have a cool year this year and people say, see, we don't have global warming. There are so many trends, and Kathy Dowd, who is Augustana College prof, who was here last week, was talking about the global warming issue and how consensus is now, it's 99 point some percent. I actually gave a talk on the abuse of science this way and how business has been using it to distort reality, and I gave a talk on this, and it really is corrupt. How used to be that we'd use research, we'd agree we're going to use the facts, and we're going to try and come to use those facts, and we might disagree on the policy, but how we deal with those facts was a fact we were dealing with. Now we have phony facts, and you pay the researchers to do the results you want to have. And the media, to a certain point, falls for that. To a point, it's lazy. What do we do about it? You need media watchdogs to call them on it. I think we have to find some way out of the money talking in journalism too, because as radio stations and TV and newspapers are being bought up and the rate of return isn't high enough, they doctor the coverage that way. But the bottom line, I won't go into this now, but bottom line is it's destroying our political process, because if you want to be, people say 10 years ago, they'd ask, well, how do you suggest we get informed? Well, you can read the paper, you can get on a mailing list at the Capitol, you can do this, but none of them were very ideal. Now the internet and other things, there are a lot more sources, but it's not educating the massive number, the general public. It educates the activist who's interested in learning about a specific issue. And there is no good way to do it, and we ought to hold the media accountable, we ought to hold politicians accountable. If we give fluff to the public comes to expect fluff. So first time I ran, I put 30 pages of issue papers together, which people joked only my opponent read. But some people did read parts of it. It was available for those that won, and even if it's 5% of the electorate, I wanted them to have it. But and the public has a responsibility, too, to demand more. I'm not sure what the answer to it is. I'll just tell you, I agree with you that the media's done a very poor job in recent years, and they feel they're doing a good job.
Right.
They think they're doing good.
I used to think until a couple of years ago that campaign financing by all these large gifts was bad, but maybe you could work through, maybe people could have these private organizations, and if they, lobbyists wanted to advertise or spend their money doing that, that was okay. I'm not sure that I agree with that anymore because of the way the last couple of elections have gone and tax-exempt groups that...
They're driving. In Minnesota politics, because we have spending limits, as I said, the system's crumbling over time.
Yeah.
State Senate race, my race, the most I can spend this year is like $60,000. We actually did put in a piece where my opponent, who's a first-time candidate, can spend 10% more. So it actually helped level out the incumbent advantage even. But we have those limits. But now we've got to the point where some... interest groups, the parties generally, are putting big money in one House race where the spending limit's half of ours. One House race, both sides combined put in about $300,000, about five times what the two candidates together could spend. And I think we ought to be very troubled by it. I think the U.S. Supreme Court has said some things that make a lot of campaign finance reformers say, we can't do anything about it. I think they're misreading what the courts are saying. The courts have said in a number of cases, we hold strict scrutiny, our toughest standard for First Amendment, because this is political speech, to prove that you should be able to put this limit on. And I think the issue is, I don't disagree with them at all about the importance of the First Amendment. I've actually, in my campaign finance bill, I quote the Supreme Court talking about the importance of the First Amendment, getting diverse points of view, the widest possible perspectives in there. And my point is they acknowledge they don't understand the political system, they don't run for office, and that they will defer to Congress, they will defer to legislatures that come up with schemes as long as they justify it. And I think campaign finance reformers can't be lazy, they have to show it. And my point is that money, if you double the amount of money in the campaign process, you don't double the amount of information. you don't even increase it by 5%. You may actually decrease the amount of information people get because you're running so many repetitive ads, people just shut down the whole thing, and you're shutting out any point of view that doesn't have billions of dollars. So, yeah, I think I share your concern. I don't think just indirect giving to interest groups is an okay way around it. But Bill, you had...
I was just going to say, to take a slightly less negative slant on all of this, I'm reading a book right now, Stephen Ambrose's Nothing Like It in the World, about the Transcontinental Railroad. And his whole premise is that, aside from all the engineering feats and the incredible labor that had to be brought to bear, there was nothing like this infusion of capital that had to be brought into the situation to motivate and to generate all the activity of the engineering and all the labor and the moving of materials and the shipping of stuff and so forth and so on. And so I guess my premise, if I go with Ambrose, is that there are these larger public works that really do take more than just private money or public dollars, and that a stadium might be an example. I'm not sure I agree with that, but I'm just saying that there are going to be these large public works kinds of projects that come along that really take an infusion of both private and governmental.
Sure, I'm not arguing that government shouldn't invest in things. I was accused of trying to have government invest in too many things at times, but I think we should invest wisely where it makes sense to do. I have no objection to, I think we should be doing what they did then, rebuilding our railroad system. I think it's a public utility. I think we ought to be investing in our public utilities, whether it's water, whether it's transportation infrastructure, whatever. We ought to be investing in that. My drawing the line, I don't even object to us investing in nonprofits, arts things. I object to investing in private businesses because, among other things, where do we determine who gets the money? It's who lobbies best. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very pure and simple. If you're a business, you lobby government. We have tax increment financing, which most states have. It's a way of sounding like it's not really public money, but it very much is. We have that happening where in Minnesota, they kicked out a lot of small businesses in a building in St. Paul, tore down the building, built a new one, gave it to this new firm, because they were moving 300 jobs across the river from Minneapolis, which really didn't quite even materialize, but it was $50, $100 million of public money to shut down these private businesses and replace it with somebody else. Why? Because that was in the public interest? No, because they lobbied heavily and convinced the public officials it was. And this year we funded two of the three stadiums we were proposed. One was the Twins, the other one was Minnesota Gophers, one in outdoor football. They tore down their own stadium 20 years ago, and they've been playing in the Metrodome for the past 15 years or so, and they want to play outdoors on campus. And hey, I remember Memorial Stadium. I'd like to have it back. But I said, hey, I have no philosophical objection to that whatsoever, and I was actually glad I was going to be able to support a stadium funding, because I was anti-stadiums in the media, and I was going to be able to prove it. Just happened that, practically speaking, I couldn't support it because the subsidy for taxpayers was going to equal, for every seat at every game, was going to be over $34 a seat, $1.7 million per home game for the next 25 years. That was a little more money than I thought we had a priority for in state government. But again, it's a public use. It's a public institution. We're not doing it to give somebody more profit. And therefore, there was nobody with big, deep pockets lobbying for it. Except maybe the newspapers, I guess. They seem to be lobbying pretty heavily. But again, I have no objection to it. I just think the idea of giving government subsidies to private business is where you get the corruption, in the sense that people give the money. And I'm using the word that you want me to anyway. But yeah, I feel comfortable using it. Brad.
I'm interested in your thoughts on both term limits on politician size any kind of impact on campaign finance with term limits?
Term limits certainly would. That's kind of a movement that came and went, partly because there was so much hypocrisy on it.
I think California, you don't want term limits.
Disaster in that way. Well, Eastern Washington, probably 10, 12 years ago, those of you who live in the Spokane area and so on, I can't even think of the guy's name, but he defeated the Speaker of the House.
Nethercutt.
Nethercutt. He defeated the Speaker of the House, saying, we got this long-term stuff, he ran on that issue and promised, I think it was 6 years, three terms. And at the end of 6 years, he kind of changed his mind. He decided there was some wisdom in having long-term perspective. Does it change the impact of money? I would argue, at least in state level, I think it would make it worse because you have no history, no anything else. Some lobbyist comes in there, they help fund your campaign, and campaigns may, at least the initial one, might be a little more competitive, but there's a lot of money in them. These folks funded your campaign, they come to your door, we need your help on this. There's no institutional memory saying, you know, these guys schnookered the previous legislature on that. I actually think it would tend to make it worse. I don't think it's a big issue now because I think a lot of the states that have them, there's a lot of talk of bailing out, and a lot of the people who campaigned on them 10, 12 years ago changed their mind. And again, Nethercutt was the poster child for that. He's still in office, right? Yeah. I remember when he was breaking, there was some guy following him around in some costume talking about broken pledges and so on. But I think I better cut it off for lack of time. I'm happy to stay around for a few more minutes and answer questions and discuss it more. But thank you for your attention.